Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Okay, so you're an aspiring ecological engineer. Your dream, designing a more sustainable future. And that dream got closer with a new fellowship at the MIT Media Lab. You're planning to apply. You're already thinking about moving your family to Cambridge next year, planning for the impact that you're going to be able to have on a climate crisis that is hammering at the Commonwealth shores right now. And then that dream's over. The fellowship canceled because a company in the murky world of cryptocurrency exchange goes bankrupt. Billions lost in days. A $12 billion industry in Massachusetts, according to the state legislature, shaken to its foundations. That's all true. It's the collapse of FTX. And whether you've embraced crypto and know what blockchain means, or you think it's all just some kind of mumbo-jumbo funny money, the collapse matters for us here. Joining us now to talk about it, Yasmeen Ammer, WBUR business reporter, who has been following this story. Thank you for coming in.
Of course. Thank you, Tiziana.
I have so many questions.
As do a lot of people, to be fair.
So let's just start with what happened with FTX exactly, sort of in lay terms.
Absolutely. FTX is a company that held people's cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is a type of digital money, and that company, it allowed people to exchange that money, that cryptocurrency. So you can use one type of coin to buy another coin, trade, sell, all the stuff that you can just do on a stock exchange, for example.
Okay. And so cryptocurrency is not one kind of currency. It's like lots of different kinds of money, and this place held that like a bank would.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly how it works. It's okay. There are different types of coins out there, and some people want to use like Bitcoin, which is a popular one, to buy another type of coin.
Okay. So then they go down in a, not admiringly spectacular fashion. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So the people at the top, so I'm sure you've heard the name Sam Bankman-Fried. What happened is that he held two companies, so FTX and Alameda. And what happened is he took people's money, like people who thought their money was safe, and he made risky bets with his other company. So it was just it was shady practice. It was just not telling people that they were just doing risky bets. And so when the risk all came to a crash, people lost money, unfortunately.
So kind of a story as old as time, actually.
It's not anything really different. It's just a central actor behaving badly. We've seen this before. We've seen schemes before. We've seen shady practices before where people didn't know where their money was going.
Like the Bernie Madoff pyramid scheme.
Absolutely.
My understanding is like 500 people in Massachusetts lost money.
Yes.
On that.
Yes.
Okay. But we cannot avoid that there is this other set of things going on, which is blockchain and cryptocurrency. And this is an opportunity to understand that piece of this. So first, I learned in preparing for today, not the same thing. The blockchain is sort of a platform, and then crypto is money. So they're not the same thing, right?
No, and a lot of people think those are interchangeable terms just because cryptocurrency is people's introduction into blockchain, but they're not the same. Think of blockchain as this foundational technology where so many things are built on it, including cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is one part of it.
Kind of like the internet, almost.
Yes, absolutely. Like the internet, and then you build all these apps and websites and whatever. Think about how many things we've built on the internet. I mean, so we don't have to get into the weeds about how blockchain works. That's for people, if they want to curl up with a nice engineering book on a Friday night, if you're into that. But I do think the best way to answer what blockchain is to tell you what allows us to do and why so many people are into it.
Good.
It's basically a technology that allows you to make transactions. But think about how you make transactions now. If I want to give you money, if I want to send you money, I have to go through a bank, right? Or I have to, go through Venmo or some central actor. What blockchain does is allows you to make direct peer-to-peer transactions in a way that is transparent, that can't be tampered with, and without a central actor. So if I were to send you like cryptocurrency, for example, like it would just be from me to you, right? I would not need a bank necessarily, and you could tell exactly how much I sent you, and no one can mess with that transaction. So if
I wanted to send money to my kid at college,
mm-hmm.
my kid would not need to have a bank account in the same bank as me. I wouldn't need to go into the banking app, blah, blah, blah. I just send my kid some money.
Just wallet to wallet. And when you think about that, that is revolutionary because we've always had to go through somebody to make transactions, right? And so that's why people are so into it, because it's so direct and easy, and also does a good job in maintaining transparency along with privacy. People don't know who needs to send you money, so that's the good thing about
it. Okay, so one quick question on the technology here, and then we'll move on.
Sure.
So you said lots of different kinds of currencies. I'm assuming that, like, if I wanted to convert a euro to a U.S. dollar, it just does all of that. Or do you have to do it yourself?
Well, you kind of have to transfer yourself.
Okay.
Yeah. So if I want to send you Bitcoin, I can send you Bitcoin. There are platforms out there that transfer that money for you, or exchange that money for you. But it kind of gets into
a whole other thing. Let's move all this back to Boston here, because what started all of this is this collapse. We are a $12 billion industry as of June, according to the state legislature. Our listeners, when we reached out to our texting group, and you can join that by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382, they raised a collective eyebrow on this. So, for example, Kay in Marblehead said, crypto's a scam. If it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. But this is an industry here. What is the industry like in Massachusetts?
Yeah, so as you said, it is so much beyond actual cryptocurrency. And that's kind of the point I want to get across. I'm not like saying yes to blockchain or no to blockchain. I'm just telling you it is a technology that people are building different things on. The people I spoke to are building messaging apps on blockchain. They're building platforms for musicians to share their music and distribute to distribute profits. And so it's just different. And what your listener touches on here is something very important. If it's too good to be true, it is too good to be true.
So and that I holds.
Not, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. The whole idea is we've been treating blockchain and cryptocurrency as this speculative asset. Like, if I hang on to this, maybe one day I'll be rich. And you've got to remember, it's risk. It's the same way if you buy a risky stock or put money in a risky investment. And so what a lot of people in Massachusetts are telling me is look at the projects on blockchain. Like, does it have value? And if it has value, you can invest in it.
And it has value.
And it has value. And so all these people who are kind of getting returns like 20, at some point, like some coins were giving like 20% returns, which, yeah, you got to look at what they're doing, like, and what is actually behind that 20% return.
So in reaction to this collapse, what have you been hearing in the local community?
So what I've been hearing in the local community, I do want to, I spoke to Kate Lipper-Garabedian. She is a representative, and she wants to start a commission on blockchain in the legislature. So she wants to study it, and she also wants to have money set aside for people to actually learn about the industry and maybe grow the industry. Because listen to what she says about really what she thinks about blockchain.
Cryptocurrency remains only one way in which we use blockchain technology, and there are many other practices in which it can be deployed that are going to be critical and frankly become integrated into the way we do business.
So her sentiment touches on something I've heard from a lot of people, and that is, again, this is beyond cryptocurrency. It is a technology. In some ways, it is inevitable that people are going to be working on this technology. If you want to think about like the late 90s and early 2000s, so many companies, internet companies, went bust. But like the internet didn't go away.
Right. And it did change everything.
It did change everything. And so I hear that sentiment from people a lot, that it is just something we're going to have to deal with and make it more responsible and mature the industry a little bit. But all these collapses, it's a black eye and it's going to slow things down, but it's not going to totally get rid of it.
All right. The collapse of FTX, which is a cryptocurrency exchange. And to put it in perspective, cryptocurrency and blockchain, a roughly $12 billion industry here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The aftershocks continue. For example, BlockFi, another cryptocurrency exchange that borrowed $400 million from FTX, also declared bankruptcy this week. And now we have started to see lawsuits, including against some very familiar Boston names, especially in the sports world. So you've got Red Sox slugger David Ortiz. You've got Tom Brady, his ex-wife Gisele Bündchen. Others being sued for their part in endorsing the now defunct FTX. Raises a lot of questions about the law, regulation, what we do and don't know, and that's the piece that we're going to tackle now. Still with us, WBUR business reporter Yasmeen Ammer, and joining us now, labor attorney and former candidate for Massachusetts Attorney General, Shannon Liss Reardon. Thanks for sticking with us, Yasmeen.
Yep.
And Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I do want to just note, if you missed the conversation we had several minutes ago with Yasmeen that sort of says, what is the blockchain? What is crypto? How does this work? You can catch that on our website at radioboston.org. I'm not going to lie, I understood it for the first time after learning from Yasmeen, so feel free to check that out. So now, Shannon, let's go to the legal implications, because now we've got these lawsuits against famous people who did commercials. Is that weird?
Well, you know, we have seen this story play out before. This is not the first time. Sadly enough, I don't think this is going to be the last time we're going to see this kind of situation unfold. I mean, essentially what we have here is a relatively new industry that few people understand, and that really gave an opportunity for someone to go in there and take advantage of the holes we have in our regulatory process. So now that the whole thing has collapsed and we're seeing lawsuits filed against people like Tom Brady, who was a bit of a spokesperson for this company, I think the legal issues for people like that, it's going to turn on, you know, what did they know? How involved really were they in what was going on here? Were they aware of the fraud that was being committed? Those are the kinds of issues that are going to be explored in litigation that is already underway.
All right. So let's play a little bit of an FTX ad that Tom Brady was featured in. Here it is.
I'm getting into crypto with FTX. You in?
Well, providing gives 360-degree access to the crypto markets with the ability to trade everything from alts to DeFi. I believe I'm in, but still hate you.
Understood.
So, did he really endorse the product there? I mean, why is that problematic?
Well, I mean, I don't know how this is going to come out for people like him. I mean, he obviously lent his prestige, his fame. People trusted him. So, you know, it's apparent that lawyers who are trying to get compensation now for people who lost money here are going to try to go after targets and figure out where there may be some wrongdoing. I think in his case, there's going to be questions about, you know, what did he know, and did he knowingly support a company that he knew or should have known was very dangerous and could lead to the kind of devastating losses that we're now seeing for people.
So I want to hold up a sort of a comparison. Okay, so we pulled some sound from a Sullivan Tire ad. This one's from 2008. This is Dustin Pedroia of the Boston Red Sox in a Sullivan Tire ad. Here we go.
Okay, Dustin, what does this vehicle need?
I'd replace the brake pads and rotors, flush the transmission fluid, and rotate the tires.
Dustin, you certainly know your way around this car.
Well, I spent a lot of time in my family's tire store. Game time.
At Sullivan Tire, we're always here to get you there.
So everybody gets tires, right? A, I'm skeptical he knew that much about that car. But is he responsible for knowing the books of Sullivan Tire, who I am not comparing to FTX, let me be clear. Is he responsible for knowing the books of Sullivan Tire? Do we hold endorsers accountable, for knowing the company and its business operations?
You know, again, I think the facts are always going to depend on the case, you know, what the endorser actually knew or what the endorser should have known. Sometimes when you're selling fairy dust and it should be apparent to a prudent investor or endorser, you know, to ask some questions, but then you're putting your reputation on the line to support something, there's some risk there.
And of course, a tire is a lot more concrete, right? So you had a question for Shannon, Yasmeen.
I did. Just hearing you I know you said it depends on the case and it depends on how much he knew. He reportedly did have money in FTX. So I'm wondering if that factors in at all. But mainly, I am actually curious about precedent. Has anybody ever been held, or how frequently are people held liable for things that they advertise?
You know, the comparison that just comes to mind most strikingly with this whole story is, frankly, Bernie Madoff and what happened when his empire and Ponzi scheme collapsed. He declared that he single-handedly ran the whole Ponzi scheme himself and that no one else knew what he was up to. You know, the authorities started coming after others who were close to him, his sons in particular, you know, who denied knowing anything. You know, so I think we're in it's a comparable situation here where people who were enabling this founder to do what he was doing, were they knowledgeable? Should we expect them to have been knowledgeable? You know, what were some of the inside conversations like that we don't have access to now? Did they know, you know, really what kind of risk they were putting people at by endorsing this product?
And of course, Yasmin, senior executive team at FTX, many with strong Boston roots, as I understand it, including, you know, one that graduated from Newton North High School. So we could see this come home in some other ways, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of them went to MIT, and so it'll be interesting to see the implications here. A lot of them had money in different parts of the economy in Massachusetts.
I have to say a broader issue that's really raised by this is when you have these new industries, you know, who really sell themselves on doing something new. No one's done it before and no one really understands it that well. So you just explained so that now we understand better what this whole industry is about. There's a lot of opportunity for abuse and fraud and people to be taken advantage of. And it's unfortunate that in technology in particular, a lot of times, you know, regulation, federal and state laws just don't keep up with what is happening with the technology. And Elizabeth Warren has an editorial out in the Wall Street Journal about the problems where we have these huge gaps in regulation. And it's also particularly concerning when you have someone in the industry who's trying to supposedly support the regulation to legitimize what they're doing. That just raises a lot of red flags. And I worry about regulation that could legitimize very problematic business practices in the first place. So we need to keep a close eye on how that evolves.
I'm really glad you brought that up because we've got both Senator Elizabeth Warren in this space. We've also got Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss in this space. Let's start with Warren. We've got some sound from her in July talking about the need for regulating crypto.
According to the Federal Trade Commission, since the start of 2021, about one in every $4 that consumers were defrauded out of, totaling about $1 billion, was lost in a crypto scam. And those are just the scams that are reported. Today is about scams, but crypto is not an industry with a few scam artists operating around the fringes. Crypto is an industry that is built to favor scammers. And some of the biggest players in our financial system are in on the con.
So, Shannon, is it that it's built to favor scammers, or is it just that it's immature and unsophisticated or running behind the development of the industry?
I mean, well, if you think about it, what is the whole point of this technology or crypto itself? I mean, in a way, you can see it as a way of just avoiding financial regulation. You know, it's a way of skirting or an attempt to skirt the whole securities industry, the regulatory framework we have in this country to control and regulate financial transactions. You know, you see Vladimir Putin saying that we should be enabling crypto. That should raise some real eyebrows about what the whole point of this industry is and why we need these kinds of investments in the first place.
And yet, Yasmin, you've talked to people in the industry who are agreeing to some extent, yes?
People, I will say, you are absolutely right to mention that initially it was seen as a way to skirt regulation, and a lot of people are still anti-regulation. But a lot of the people in the industry, especially here who I spoke to, are really warming up. They
starting
think
to hunger for it a little.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, you know, one, our biggest crypto company in Boston, a Circle. I spoke to Jeremy Allaire, the CEO, actually back in May when the last collapse happened. And this is what he had to say.
So we welcome regulation. We think it's critical. There's a kind of social contract that exists between kind of financial infrastructure and society. And that's important. It's important in terms of those that sort of social compact around consumer protection, financial inclusion, safety and soundness, you know, these kinds of things.
And actually, a lot of people I spoke to think that as part of a maturing industry, they acknowledge that a ton of people lost money and they don't want this bad reputation on like the blockchain technology as a whole. And so inviting regulation maybe is a way to even get more investors comfortable, more consumers comfortable with the technology, with maybe crypto or beyond crypto. So that's kind of the warming up to regulation that I've been mentioning.
But that's the kind of regulation from that angle is what causes me concern. When actors in an industry are inviting regulation in order to legitimize what they've been doing. And the other example that I can't help but compare this to is the rise of Uber and all of these tech companies that claimed to have developed something completely new, revolutionized our transportation system. And you have a company like that who came into a space that wasn't really regulated because no one had seen anything quite like it before. So they burst onto the scene, do whatever they want, pretty much just ignore all of our laws and just do what they want. And then after the fact, say, oh, hey, come back. We're open to regulation. Regulate us so that it will seem legitimate what they've done. So I'm concerned about the kind of regulation that after the fact legitimizes a very problematic industry. I believe Elizabeth Warren is calling for is that we need to make sure that holes are plugged in our current system to ensure that, even when people are coming onto the scene saying they've got something brand new, a lot of times it's not anything brand new. Our current laws, if just enforced properly, could stop these scams and protect people.
Okay, so two things. One, Shannon Liss-Riordan, correct me if I'm wrong. You have in the past been engaged in lawsuits for workers against Uber. Is that correct?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I want to hit one other thing here. There's been some much made about Congressman Jake Auchincloss, Massachusetts Democrat, who was part of four Republicans who sent a letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission questioning the legality about a process they were using to investigate cryptocurrency companies. And the accusation against that letter was that it might have a slowing effect on this. So I want to say we reached out. He wasn't available, but his team sent a comment, quote, "The congressman has been clear from day one that crypto needs strong and clear laws from Congress. The SEC will need to explain to Congress why, despite claiming that it didn't need new laws for crypto, it failed to foresee this meltdown," end quote. They also pointed out to us that the congressman pushed Gary Gensler, who's the chair of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, for new regulations back in October of 2021. We have about a minute left. And what I want to know, Shannon, is you just argued we don't need anything new. We need to enforce what we've got. Are we sure there's nothing new that needs to come in a space this, as Yasmin has pointed out, uncharted or newly charted?
I'm not saying that we don't need anything new. I just think it's very important that we look at potential regulation with an eye toward, is this going to be protecting people going forward? Is this going to plug up holes in our regulatory structure? Or is it a way of backdoor legitimizing practices in an industry that really need to be rethought in the first place?
And Yasmina Ammer, last question to you. What are you going to be watching going forward?
I'm going to be watching all of the projects that are happening around Massachusetts and the ones that are beyond cryptocurrency. I am actually curious what kinds of blockchain, what falls and what rises, because that's inevitably what's going to happen. It's what happened in the late 90s and early 2000s with internet companies. And so I think we're going to inevitably see a maturing industry. I just don't know what that looks like
yet. So you're watching for the shakeout.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Yasmin Ammer is WBUR business reporter. Shannon Liss-Riordan is a Massachusetts-based labor attorney and former candidate for Massachusetts Attorney General. Super helpful. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you ready? It is that time. That is the Boston Pops playing Sleigh Ride, featured in a video to kick off the 2022 Holiday Pops tomorrow night, Symphony Hall. Conductor Keith Lockhart joins us now. Keith, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana. Good to talk to you.
You too. So I have to ask you, do you play any holiday music at home, or is that like work for you, and so at home you're playing something else?
Well, I don't play a whole lot of music at home to begin with. People ask, you know, what do you listen to when you kick back? And I say, well, nothing. That having been said, there, you know, we have kids at home and holiday music is an important part of that. And what we really try to do, we don't play any holiday music really till we get up to Christmas Day. And then on Christmas Day, we gather around the piano and get all of them to do their renditions of their favorite carols. So we get some practice in too.
Okay, so you got to tell us a couple of the carols that appear at the Lockhart family piano.
Well, they're always asking me which my favorite are. And Christopher, my youngest, has decided that my favorite is the Christmas song, the Mel Torme classic.
Yeah.
So he's figured out how to play it on alto sax. And I often get serenaded by that. Whereas the 12-year-old, Kellen, prefers the kind of more stentorian Lutheran sort of Christmas carols.
So a little bit of all of it for you.
Exactly. But I've always loved the music of this season. And I think that's probably good because after 27 years, if I didn't love this music, I would have been driven stark raving mad.
Yeah, because it's like 27, 37 performances every December, basically.
It is this year in total. The whole organization is doing 39, starting on Thursday and ending on Christmas Eve. And that's actually down probably about 30% from pre-pandemic levels.
Yeah, yeah. And you're performing not just at Symphony Hall, but there are some other places that you're performing. I think, Worcester, Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, for years, we've gone around to a number of regional venues. We really think of them as part of the holiday tradition. Some of those people, of course, come into Boston to hear the show in Symphony Hall. But for years, we played up in Manchester, New Hampshire. We open our short tour in Worcester this coming Friday. And let me see, we play in stores on the UConn campus and also in Lowell at the Memorial Auditorium. And we've done that pretty much ever since I've been here.
All right, let me give listeners dates on that. Stores, Connecticut, I think, is December 3rd. Manchester, New Hampshire is December 10th. And Lowell is December 18th. So you mentioned the fact that it's a lot of performances, fewer than before the pandemic. I was thinking a lot, you know, the sing-along is back this year. And in fact, I'm going to give a little sound here. This is a little bit of a holiday pop sing-along that was at the Prudential Center outside back in 2010. Does it mean a lot to you to be able to bring the sing-along? This is the first year back, yeah, with the
it
sing-along.
It does. I mean, it's always been, I mean, what we try to do here in Symphony Hall for Holiday Pops is a blend of traditions, of familiar things, of things that people can come back to year after year and, you know, especially these days, go, at least that's still here. You know, thank yeah. God that's still with us. Plus, of course, new stories to tell, new songs to sing, new ways of expressing the hopes and the celebration of the holiday season. But one of the most important traditions is the sing-along. And I think it's important. It extends a long way beyond just what we do here in the hall. What an amazing time of the year that you can get 2,000 people, 1,500 of which would never open their mouths to sing in public at any other point, howling along together joyfully in songs of the season. I think it's an amazing gesture and says a lot more than just its place on the program. So last year we missed it because of course lingering nervousness about that much aerosol. And
of course, Omicron was right on the heels. So
right. Yes. And, you know, we honestly, obviously, we're not totally out of the woods yet. But I think a lot of people are thinking at some point we have to go on and live our lives.
So that is my question on this, because I'm imagining the first night, right? Everybody, that collective 2,000 people, as you said, 1,500 of whom would never open their mouths, take a deep breath. Do you anticipate that split second of trepidation or sort of headfirst gusto? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, my crystal ball doesn't work any better than anybody else's does these days.
Yeah, but you know that audience and you know that place.
Yes. What I do think is what we experienced when we came back for the first time at the beginning of the holiday season last year. There was nothing sadder than 2020 and not being able to gather in community. It was unbridled passion and excitement. Everybody was really over the top. Everybody was so excited to be there. Everybody left their fears aside for, you know, at least those couple of hours. And I think that's a really important thing to be able to offer people.
So let's talk about the newness that you referred to a minute ago. And I'm going to play a little sound here and I'll tell you what it is. You're going to know it, but I'll tell you what it is afterward. So that is the Ukrainian Bell Carol Chorus from a performance by the Chernivtsi Vocal Group, 2010, Lviv. And you are bringing Ukrainian carols into the performance. Talk about that.
Well, each year when we do this, when we plan a new program, we try to think about, well, what's on people's minds, what's in people's hearts. And over the last quarter century, that's been a lot of different things, including the first Christmas after 9/11 and the marathon bombing and strife within our country, strife without our country. And obviously, people have thought about a lot more about Ukraine than they had at any other point in their lives over these last 9 months. And that conflict is still very much present. And it's a country with a really rich, mostly Eastern Orthodox Christmas tradition. And we started thinking, well, what better time to bring some of that music and just remind people that there are people who are celebrating the season under extremely challenging circumstances. So we look through the rest of the tradition. Everyone knows the Ukrainian Bell Carol, otherwise known as Carol of the Bells.
But I bet a lot of people didn't know it was Ukrainian.
Didn't know it was Ukrainian, right. The people have called it for years. They called it just Carol of the Bells. And that is an old traditional tune set originally in a non-folk way in 1914, I think, and first heard over here in 1922 as part of a Ukrainian National Chorus sold-out tour across this country, which was part of the then Soviet states publicity campaign, basically, between the two wars. Then we looked further into the tradition and found all these wonderful pieces and picked one that our chorus could sing in Ukrainian. We've been working with a Ukrainian singer to work and get that just right. As you probably know, it's not an easy language. The one we picked is called Dobry Vechir Tobi, which means good evening, people. And it's basically a Here We Come a Wassailing song where a group of carolers will go door to door and remind the master and mistress of the house that it's polite at this time of the year to invite them in for some food and drink.
So I'm going to play a little sound in the background as we go on here. We spoke with, at the beginning of the conflict, we spoke with Olga Lisovska, who's a Ukrainian singer, an opera singer, immigrant to the U.S., and sang us a song called The Prayer for Ukraine as a way to connect us and our listeners with the Ukrainian community. Here's a little bit of Olga. And it gives a sense of the language and the feel. And what are the connections that are important to you to make among the audience during this holiday season every year in connecting the audience to the broader community? What's the vision there for you?
Well, one of the interesting connections to make right off the bat is Olga is indeed the singer who has been coaching our association. So that was a really wonderful Christmas miracle right there.
That is so cool.
Well, each year, you know, we try to think about what people are celebrating. We try to think about what people fear. We gather together in community once a year, and I mean, people have various reasons for doing that, some of them celebratory and some of them a little bit more thoughtful. But I think at the core of it is that we all need to come together, hold hands possibly, and say, it can be better than this, it will be better than this. That if there is no season of hope, where you look to ideals, you look to spiritual ideals, you look to religious ideals of how the world can be, then it's very difficult to go on with our lives, especially, you know, where everything seems to be flipping upside down as it has been in the last few months. So we hope to, you know, send people back out into the night joyous, happy, sometimes a little bit tipsy, but most of all, with a renewed sense of the possibilities that the holiday season is there to remind us of.
All right. Keith Lockhart is the conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra. And if you'd like tickets to one of the 34 shows in Boston and around Massachusetts, you can find them at bostonpops.org. Keith, thank you.
Thank you, Tizia. Happy holidays.
You too.